Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast. I am back from Hawaii. Excuse me, it's been that kind of day. And I am still a little jet lagged and frazzled. It was, I left Hawaii at 2 p.m. Hawaii time, got to LA around 9:30. Had a layover there. Nothing was open. And then had a red eye from LA to DC, leaving at midnight, that got me in around, I don't know, 8 or something like that. And then no chance to sleep all day yesterday. And then this morning I had to get up super early to do NPR. And then I had to make the pasta sauce, but you know, the helicopters were following me everywhere I went, even when I dropped off the guns. So I'm a little, jangly, and I apologize to people about it. Also, this was a messed up week. I should say, brought to you by the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. Go to thedispatch.com. We really knocked that out of the park this week, did some wonderful stuff. It chagrins me a little bit that I think probably our best week was when I was mostly MIA. But I'm so proud of our team and our guys, and we did such a great job covering all of this. And you know, I worked on the editorial, our first editorial, calling to impeach and all of that. I'm not going to mention our sponsors today because we have this new format for it. So I know some people really love my segues, and I'm going to try and figure out some alternative way of that kind of thing. But for the time being, let me just say thank you to our sponsors. Why don't we start there with this crazy week? I'll just be upfront about it. I think it would be the best thing possible for America would be if we could impeach and remove Donald Trump. I think I had a little spat with Britt Hume about this on Twitter. Yes, I think it's very unlikely that it'll happen. Yes, I think it would be very difficult. Yes, I think the Democrats, who very well may impeach him again, from what I'm hearing, But it's very possible that they'll screw it up in such a way that Republicans won't sign on to it and it'll become more of a mess. And that's entirely possible. Also, I should say, and I'm recording this late on Friday, you know, there's this whole story about how Nancy Pelosi talked to the Pentagon about Trump and the nuclear codes and all of this stuff. And I think that this is a terrible, terrible storyline, and that Pelosi has made just a really terrible partisan-driven mistake here. Because first of all, if this was something that you really, really cared about, you would not go public with this information. You would not leak it. You would not tell the world about this disarray in the chain of command with the nuclear codes. You would just make sure that, you know, the issue was handled and you could talk about it later. This sends a very bad message, I think, around the world. Moreover, look, I think my record of being critical of Donald Trump is secure, but I do not think there's a very high probability that Donald Trump is looking to launch a nuclear weapon. The idea that this is something that we should be gravely concerned about, or that the military would go along with in the last 10, 12 days of his presidency, I think is just... it's sort of a variation of resistance porn. In fact, I don't think that there's a lot that the president can't, well, I think there's a lot he could do that would be even worse than what happened Wednesday, but I don't think it's very likely that he would, they would do or will do very much for the last few days of his presidency. The reason why I'm in favor of impeaching and removing Donald Trump is not primarily to prevent him from doing more damage while president. The primary reason why I want to see him impeached and removed is that, first of all, on the merits, I think he deserves to be. I thought it was a tougher call with the impeachment phone call, but I was in favor of impeachment back then too. But I don't begrudge, people who thought that what he did was very bad, but it didn't rise to the level of necessarily of impeachment. But what he did here, I think, definitely rises to the level of impeachment. But more importantly, I think we need it for basically civic hygiene purposes. I think it is really important for the future of the country that you send a signal into the system for the rest of this country's life that doing what he did is going to have severe consequences. And, Donald Trump is shameless, and presumably future demagogues would be shameless too. They just might be better at doing the kind of stuff that Trump tried to do. And having the country speak with an official voice to say that this is unacceptable, I think is just, would be the best case scenario going forward. Also, it would remove for all time the possibility, if they voted the right way, there's some technical stuff, to bar him from future public office. Just take the question of whether he's going to run again off the table. It's funny, one of the reasons why FDR ushered in the two limit terms to the presidency was that for a lot of Republicans, people thought, we don't need to go chapter and verse into all of this, but they thought that FDR basically ruled like an autocrat. I generally agree with them. That doesn't mean that, FDR is not the evil figure in my mind that Woodrow Wilson was. But the way they sold it to people, if I remember this right, is that for Democrats, many of whom didn't like that he basically made himself president for life either, but they weren't going to say it, the Democrats sold it as no other president will deserve this honor of exceeding two terms. And for Republicans, it was no other president will be able to do what FDR did by just basically making himself president for life. But it's worth pointing out, that was what FDR did was a major violation of norms. The tradition of only two terms was rock solid until FDR became president, and he just didn't want to relinquish power. Now, it is entirely possible to me that somebody with that same desire and impulse down the road could look at what Donald Trump tried to do here and figure out a better way of pulling it off. And sending a signal for all time that this is intolerable behavior just strikes me as the right thing to do. Secondarily or tertiarily to all of that, I think it would be great for the Republican Party. Everyone understands where I'm coming from on Trump. I think he's been bad for the country. He's been bad for the party. He's been bad for American culture. And I write about that at length in the G-File today. And I think the sooner the party can expel the cult of personality that he has inflicted upon the party, the better. And forcing Republicans to take a stand on all of this would be helpful. It would be helpful to know about those who approved of his behavior inciting this riot, and it would be helpful for those who don't approve of it to actually prove it and be on the record and lay down that marker. And it also just, it would be helpful to have Donald Trump weakened as a political actor by the fact that he can't run again. I think this week hurt his chances demonstrably about running again. And if, as some of the rumors are true, that he decides to pardon himself, I think that would hurt even more. I also think pardoning yourself is an impeachable offense, by the way. And I got into this spat with Britt about it, and Britt thinks that it just can't be done. Since it can't be done, we should stop talking about it. I get the point. I mean, I like Britt, and I have my real disagreements with him sometimes, but I think the Congress could certainly do it if it wanted to. It doesn't have to hold hearings. Congress can set the rules for whatever it wants when it comes to impeachment, except for the stuff that's specifically laid out in the Constitution. And let's put it this way. If Donald Trump this week, instead of inciting a riot, said on national television that he thinks, I don't know, that it will, forget what just said something. That's a different argument. Let's say that he murdered somebody just for the sake of argument, right? Not that he has blood on his hands because of the riot stuff, though I think he does, but that's a figurative thing. Let's say he like legit murdered somebody. Regardless of the criminal penalties stuff and the questions about whether or not the president can be prosecuted for a crime while he's still in office, it seems kind of obvious to me that the House could convene with a day's notice, vote up and down on articles of impeachment, and send them to the Senate, and the Senate could, with a day's notice, vote it out. If he fulfilled his prophecy and went out on Fifth Avenue and just shot a bunch of people. Take away all the funny political, legal, you know, fanfic arguments about, you know, New York State arresting him and blah, 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 blah. Let's just say that he did it. I think everybody agrees that would be impeachable. And I think he would get impeached even if he had 48 hours left to his presidency. So it's possible you have the political will to do it. But as a practical matter, I think, you know, between the calendar and the dysfunction of the GOP and the politics of the Democrats, it's very unlikely that it'll come about. But it could be done. There was also this really strange argument that Josh Blackman, guy writing for Reason, said that the president couldn't be impeached for utilizing his free speech rights under the First Amendment. And it's an interesting sort of argument, but at the end of the day, I find it to be just a total head scratcher. You know, first of all, something doesn't have to be a crime to be impeachable. And in fact, James Madison conceded when they were debating the pardon power that, you know, if you used your pardon power to pardon people to commit crimes for you on your behalf, or if you pardoned yourself so you could commit crimes, that's fully within the president's rights, and he could still be impeached for it. If the president of the United States, you know, exercised his right of free expression and entered the Oval Office buck naked and started shouting racial epithets and insulting Christians as suckers for having put so much faith in him, and doing all that kind of stuff, you know, he might get hit with the 25th Amendment before anyone could impeach him, but that would all be free expression. And my hunch is that politicians would race for the opportunity to impeach him so that they could be on record not condoning any of that kind of stuff. So it's fairly cut and dried in the sense that what he did was inexcusable, and it would be better for civic health, and it'd be a good precedent for the future if the country spoke through its relevant institutions to simply reject the whole thing. Now, let's talk for a second, I guess, about what Trump actually did. I, as you'll see in the G file, and I don't want to really dwell on it too much here, I am really disgusted, not just with Trump's behavior, but with the mad rush to change the subject or reframe the debate into more hospitable ground for the usual Trump-supporting pundits and politicians to claim the high ground, right? And so that's part of what's going on with all of this nonsense about saying that Democrats are hypocrites or the media are hypocrites because they didn't condemn the violence of the Black Lives Matter protesters. Yeah, they're definitely hypocrites. You know, Chris Cuomo beclowned himself when he was like, where in the Constitution does it say that protests have to be peaceful? And that ramen noodle eating guy pointed out it's actually in the Constitution to peaceably assemble. Much like the epidemiologists who said mass gatherings are terrible unless you're unless you're protesting racial injustice, and then they're fine. It is perfectly legitimate to attack and criticize Democrats for being inconsistent on the issue of political or mob violence. I have no problem with that, and I agree with a lot of that. What bothers me about all of that is that by turning that into the thing to be righteously indignant about and slam the table and talk about how, you know, morally inferior the Democrats are, is that unless in the same breath and with at least equal passion, you condemn the President of the United States for inciting a mob to march on the Capitol, knowing full well that it could lead to violence. In fact, there was all sorts of warnings that there was going to be violence or that there could be violence. And being reluctant to call an end to it when, you know, among other things, a police officer was beaten to death with a fire extinguisher. And, you know, this idea that the Democrats are the inconsistent ones on violence is garbage when you're saying that to defend a president who has been at least as inconsistent about violence. You know, he did those rallies where he would talk about, you know, people getting roughed up and punched in the face. He celebrated that jackwad politician who who body slammed a reporter. He liked to talk about how he has the bikers and all the tough guys on his side. And he told this big crowd that he knew was full of Proud Boys and Groypers and, you know, what was the thing from Blazing Saddles when Slim Pickens talks about, we'll call a old number 7, I think it is, where we go, you know, riding into town, whooping and whomping, eating holly, raping the cattle and killing the women. He knew that the whole list of seedy characters that he, you know, encourages to think he's their dashboard saint. He knew they were all there. He invited them there for a wild time. And then he talks about how we have to be strength. You know, we have to be strong. We have to show strength. And yeah, I know he said that, you know, he used the word peacefully march. I get that. But, you know, he also spoke after Rudy Giuliani called for trial by combat. And also, he was riling these people up, filling their heads with all number of just wildly unsubstantiated lies and conspiracy theories about how the election was stolen, repeating things that have been debunked over and over and over again, telling these people, many of them obviously sincerely believe that the election was stolen, and then saying, go down there and put pressure on Mike Pence to steal the election for me. So even if those rioters were never violent, right, even if that crowd was never violent, what he was trying to do was still impeachable and outrageous. And the fact that it got out of hand and it was foreseeable that it would get out of hand just makes it so much worse. And if the reports are true that he couldn't understand why he should call for the National Guard to come in and put an end to it, or why he should speak out sooner to tell people to stop it, that it just goes to, you know, his state of mind that he kind of was into this. And so anyway, I think that was all horrific and detestable. And anything that the Black Lives Matter movement did this summer does not detract at all from the constitutional crime that Donald Trump committed this week. And I don't, you know, it's been this theme for 4 years of the Trump presidency, where his biggest defenders will immediately play this hypocrisy card as if it's a defense of the president. You know, it's as if, you know, that because the New York Times said something bad, then therefore it's okay that the commander in chief of the United States who's sworn to uphold the Constitution does something bad. And it's, you know, it's this inverted, perverse Alinskyism stuff that I've been railing about for so long, where you think that because you believe the worst caricature of what the other side does, that makes it okay to do the same things because you're right and they're wrong. And, you know, inciting riots is wrong, whatever the cause is. You know, that maybe not whatever the cause is. If you're in, you know, North Korea, inciting a riot might make sense. If you're in the old Soviet Union, inciting a riot might be the morally right thing to do. I certainly can't begrudge African slaves from revolting from, you know, while in bondage or anything like that. But in a nation with the rule of law that is trying to conduct the ceremonial procedures of the transfer of power to unleash mob violence or just unleash crowds to pressure politicians to do something that is unconstitutional should be impeachable. You know, and I've been making this point for a really long time, but, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole weakness of parties thing, but, you know, and I'm sure you've heard me say this a bunch of times, but, you know, one of the problems that you have with everything being transparent and in the open is that it makes it much more difficult for institutions to play their function as gatekeepers and filters and legitimizers. An example I know I've used on this podcast a bunch of times is, you know, under the old smoke-filled room system before the primaries, if you went to the governor of Pennsylvania, who controlled the delegates for the state of Pennsylvania, and said, look, I want your endorsement. And he says, okay, well, you know, what are you for? And you said, well, I'm for building this crazy wall, and we're going to take the oil, and we're going to make Mexico pay for this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to ban all Muslims, including American citizens, from the United States. The governor of Pennsylvania would say, get the hell out of here. And the same thing applies, as I always say, you know, if it had been Bernie Sanders in 2016, if he went in and said, we're going to seize the means of production and take control of the radio stations and, you know, get rid of capitalism, a Democratic governor of Pennsylvania would say, get the hell out of here. But in an age of populism where you can rile up crowds, which until this week, my argument was mostly metaphorical. If you can rile up crowds to put external pressure on institutions to make them bend to your will, then you exploit this weakness in the system that makes the gatekeepers in these institutions not necessarily powerless, but much less capable of defying popular will. It's the, you know, waving the bloody toga over Caesar's death in front of the crowd. You rile them up and you unleash them. And again, up until this week, it was largely figurative. And I was talking about, you know, getting Fox News viewers or primary voters mad, or Rush Limbaugh listeners mad. But this is different. This was literally telling a huge crowd of people and millions of people watching on TV that the election was stolen when it wasn't, lying about the evidence that the election was stolen, and then putting these people in the position who, you know, sincerely believe that the election was stolen and that they needed to prevent a coup. And then you add in the hotheads and the rabble-rousers and the crazies who are there to enrage and inflame the mob. This is much more like Roman politics than it is like American democracy. And, you know, and that gets to this other point I make in the G-File. Yeah, I get that there are lots of people out there who sadly believe the election actually was stolen. I know people who actually believe all this garbage. I have relatives who believe all of this garbage. They've been lied to. It's as simple as that. They've simply been lied to. And so you have Matt Gaetz, who, you know, looks like a steroidal Playmobil character, who is a symbol of everything I hate about what politics has become these days, going around saying or insinuating or hinting or winking, you know, that somehow this was what you deserve because people are calling people who are trying to act on what Trump is telling them secessionists and insurrectionists. And that's mean, and that hurts their feelings, and that's demonizing and offensive. And so you get, and Tucker does the same shtick. You tell people that the election, you lie to people and tell them that the election was stolen, and they act on it. And then when other people call the people who are acting on these lies liars and conspiracy theorists, well, that's outrageous, and how dare you insult them? And Tucker would have a perfectly fine point if he spent a fraction of his energy actually explaining to his own viewers that the election wasn't stolen. You can't, like, you know, play this game where you say, look, the American people, you know, look, a lot of these people are sincere in their belief that the election was stolen, and calling them conspiracy theorists or insurrectionists doesn't fix the problem. You have to persuade them. This is almost a verbatim, you know, line from Tucker from the other night, from the night of this riot. And he says, you know, you can't go around, you know, going around calling them these things is undemocratic, because all it does is tell them that you have contempt for them. Well, it seems to me the real contempt for them is not showing them the respect of actually explaining to them in plain language why the president has been lying to them. Refusing to rebut the lie is aiding and abetting the lie. And look, for all I know, Tucker has said something exculpatory on this front, but writ large, you know, all of these people, all the usual suspects, are talking about Trump voters. First of all, they talk about, you know, the 75 million Trump voters as if they are of one mind about all this stuff, which is just nonsense. But they're also saying that, you know, you can't hurt their delicate little sensibilities by telling them the truth, because this is just what they believe. And first of all, this is the exact argument that conservatives have spent 40 years railing about political correctness, about, you know, oh, look at these little snowflakes who, you know, they can't hear the truth and they need trigger warnings because they can't have their safe spaces, you know, violated by hearing unpleasant ideas or arguments. Well, the vast swath of this right-wing media complex that went along with this stuff, and not just the media, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley in particular, they are treating Trump voters and Republicans generally as if they're snowflakes who can't hear the truth, that this is all a bunch of BS. And yeah, I get it. Ted will always have an ability to come up with some lawyerly explanation about he himself wasn't actually saying the election was stolen. He was just saying, as Josh Hawley did, you know, there's just so many allegations that we owe it to people to take this seriously. Well, the allegations were raised as a concerted effort to steal the election and lie to the American people. And then saying, well, now that because they believe all the lies, we have to take them seriously and act on it in unconstitutional ways because our snowflake fans who give us small dollar contributions can't hear the truth. That's just making the problem worse. And it's grotesque to me. It's just utterly grotesque. And I'm not saying, look, I mean, if you actually believe the election was stolen, I kind of get the desire to riot and protest and all these kinds of things. I still don't think it is any excuse for the violence that we saw. It is no justification. You know, as I say in the G-File, there's one of the core ideas in conservatism is to understand the difference between an explanation and an excuse. We can talk about root causes stuff all day long if you want, about, you know, the minority communities or whatever, and you know, and historic oppression and discrimination and how that leads to results today that make crime more likely and all these kinds of things. And there are good arguments in the root causes side. But one of the bedrock positions of conservatism is that those root causes do not justify violence. They do not justify crime. And I've been listening to Pete Hegseth and all these people talking about how you have to understand their feelings. They feel like they have no voice. They feel like they've been unheard. This is the voices of the unheard. Well, first of all, that's, as I wrote my syndicated column about this, that's just garbage. It's just, what are these people talking about? You know, I mean, the idea that these 75 million people aren't heard, like the in, entire Fox viewing audience isn't has no one speaking for them, that Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz aren't, you know, acting on their behalf and speaking on their behalf. You know, the way you make yourself heard in a democracy is by voting. 75 million people voted for Donald Trump or against Joe Biden. They were heard, but something like 85 million people voted for Joe Biden or against Donald Trump. And in a democracy, that's kind of how it works, you know? Yeah, and I'm in favor of the Electoral College, unlike Hawley and Cruz and the Texas lawsuit people and all of them who wanted to just sort of just blow up the system on behalf of Donald Trump. But, you know, as a general proposition, the side that wins the election wins, and their voices get heard more, and their representatives get to go to Washington and do their stuff. And then the other side gets to argue with them and fight with them and all of that. But this idea where, like, the single highest rated television show on cable news is Tucker Carlson's, and all he does is tell the audience, you know, the stuff that they want to hear, which is that that no one is listening to them. You know, you have vast swaths of the media industrial complex that caters entirely to this very sizable part of America. And the thing is that this too is a snowflakey argument. This too is very much like the campus lefty arguments that say, look, we don't want a debate. We don't want to be told we're wrong. We want all of our feelings affirmed and ratified and respected and protected from unpleasant argument and debate. And it's just astounding to me how almost totally the right, you know, they don't quote Herbert Marcuse, and they don't talk about the Frankfurt School, and except to talk about why the other side is bad, but they don't invoke all of the intellectual gasbaggery of the sort of postmodern left to justify their positions. But their positions at the end of the day are remarkably similar to the positions of the people that they claim are all a bunch of snowflakes. You know, I mean, we're the guys who've been saying all this time, facts don't care about your feelings. And yet the argument that they're all putting, that Gates and all these people are putting forward, is that the feelings of these voters, you know, this very unsilent majority, which isn't the majority, the silent majority, which is neither silent nor a majority, that because they feel dissed and because mean people say things about him, about them, or about Donald Trump, their, you know, the vessel of their populist identity, that therefore justifies anything that they do. Well, you know, people say lots of bad things about black people in this country. That doesn't justify violence. People do a lot of bad things to black people in this country. That doesn't justify violence. But because Hillary Clinton called Donald Trump fans, or a big segment of them, deplorable people, that justifies being jackasses and trying to throw out the Constitution? It's just all such nonsense. And it's also, you know, it really is very postmodern, right? I mean, the whole, you know, 1990s postmodern thing was about, you know, the social construction of reality, and that you have to respect the, you know, we don't have to respect the existing social constructs. We can replace them with other social constructs, and they're just as true. And no one has any right to say my claims to facts are any more correct than somebody else's claims to facts are correct, and that truth is in the eye of the beholder. Well, you know, we now have vast swaths of the right talking about their truths, their facts. And when you try to debate them on it, they either say you're making it up, or that, oh, that comes from the mainstream media. You have to go to Fortran.joeshrimpshrack.com to get the real truth. And it's madness. And Tim Carney had a great piece today, we'll put in the show notes, where he makes the point, and I think he's entirely correct, that at least for a lot of the people who sincerely believe all of these conspiracy theories, this is, you know, this is as much the result of the de-Christianization or the secularization of American life as any of the nonsense that we hear from the left. People are craving something to believe in. People are craving for some cause that gives them meaning. What, you know, Ernest Gellner, this philosopher of history who I really, really like, he would call it re-enchantment creeds, right? There's this argument, I think I talked about this recently, where there's this historian, Michael Burley, who's done really amazing work on all of this stuff, about how the wars of religion never really ended. They just changed their names. And, you know, and this is something that Eric Voegelin talked about a great deal, where he talked about how, you know, that because we are inherently spiritual and religious by nature, what Will Herberg called homo religio, right, religious man, that when you get rid of or remove the traditional religious structures and institutions and creeds and beliefs, we don't necessarily all become atheists or secularists or rationalists or pragmatists or anything like that. We find something to replace the old creeds with. And, you know, Voegelin has this line. He says, when God is invisible behind the world, the contents of the world will become new gods. When the symbols of transcendent religiosity are banned, new symbols develop from the inner worldly language of science to take their place. And I've quoted that a million times. It's in my underrated book, Tyranny of Clichés. And I think it is absolutely true for a subset of sort of secular progressives, where the sort of, what's his face? Neil Tyson, is that his name? Whatever, you know, the guy who loves to debunk the science in movies where he isn't a paid consultant to. Neil deGrasse Tyson, that's it, right? There is this segment of the sort of progressive secular left going way back. I mean, going back to August Comte and his Religion of Humanity, where he wanted to make, you know, scientists and explorers and inventors into the new saints. That has been a big trend in post-religious, secular, whatever you want to call it, progressivism for over a century. And I think it's very much alive today. I think a lot of, and this is not exactly a new insight, but, you know, I think climate change is real. I don't think it's as big a problem as a lot of people claim, but I think it's something that we should take seriously. But as Michael Crichton pointed out a long time ago, it very much fits with sort of classic religious and biblical understandings of the world. You know, originally we were in a sinless, pristine world, and then through knowledge and technology, sort of basically like the apple that Eve pawns off on Adam, we became fallen and sinful, and we destroyed Eden. And then we have to have redemption by, you know, restoring the world to its, you know, this romantic vision of what it once was. This is, Al Gore talks about this a lot in Earth in the Balance with his, you know, his weird diatribes against Francis Bacon and how he bifurcated the Western mind and made us all technocrats or some drivel. It's been a long time since I read Earth in the Balance. So I think all of that is real, and it's something I wish we could get back to talking about and writing about. But I think Tim makes a very strong point that it doesn't have to be a new scientistic religion that takes the place of traditional religion. It can be cult of personality stuff. It can be conspiracy theories. It can be all sorts of things that we cram in there to fill the holes in our souls. And, you know, in Tim's book, which is really a great book, Alienated America, you know, he notes that Trump's biggest source of support was evangelicals, self-described evangelicals who do not go to church, which is a hugely important distinction. If you come from a background where you have other, and I know I'm a broken record on this, it is a big theme of Suicide of the West, but if you come from a background where you have other sources of meaning and community closer to home, you don't have to fill your soul with politics in order to find your meaning, right? This is, you know, I used to love making this point about the Life of Julia stuff and Barack Obama's second inaugural, where he would talk, you know, he talked about how the government was the only other institution other than the atomized individual. And that if you wanted community, you needed to look to the federal government for it. I hectored my wife for years to write a book called My Husband, the State, because that was sort of the, and I was telling her to do that long before the Life of Julia stuff came along. But that's a big argument within, or a big sort of theme within progressivism, is that the state is there to do all of the things that you can't do as an individual. And it leaves out all of the civil society, all of the mediating institutions, all of the Burke and Little platoons, and says, you know, there's the individual who, and the state will free you from all encumbrances to operationalizing and actualizing your personal identity. And then there's the federal state that will do all the other stuff. And that's where that phrase, you know, government is just the word we use for the things we do together. I hate that stuff. But there is this right-wing version of this, which is much less theoretical, much less adorned with ideological and intellectual arguments and accoutrement. And it just basically says, Trump's my guy, right? I mean, this is, you know, for Ernest Gellner, the guy who I was talking about, re-enchantment creeds, his big example of that was basically nationalism. Voegelin's big example of political religions, which self-consciously substituted for traditional religion, were Nazism and Soviet communism. But, you know, faith in the big man, faith in the strong man, faith in the unquestionable leader, that is a much older idea than all of these other weird re-enchantment creeds. It's a much more natural idea. And I think that, you know, there's this tendency on the right to think that all of the problems in America are outside conservative communities, that conservatism is the answer to all of the problems that plague America. Now, I actually believe that my definition of conservatism goes a long way to solving a lot of the problems in America, but not all of them. I'm not that arrogant about it. But my point, that's not my point about, it's not about public policy. It's that, you know, the glorification of the self and moral relativism and hedonism and all of these plagues that mess up modern society that conservatives are so good at describing and talking about, we very rarely say that these are problems for conservatives too. I mean, that's been changing. You know, Brad Wilcox talks about the problems of marriage. You know, there are a lot, you know, there are people who get at this stuff, and Tim got at it in his book. But as a general, you know, for example, when we used to talk about out of wedlock birth, a lot of conservatives talk about out of wedlock birth as if that was problems for those other people and not us. Well, you know, premarital sex, out of wedlock birth, family breakdown, selfishness, greed, hyper-individualism, antisocial behavior, all of these things are problems among people who vote Republican too. And for some of them, by no means all of them or even most of them, but for some of them, the reason why they're voting Republican is because they are searching for the things that are missing in their lives. And I spent much of the last 20 years making this exact point in all three of my books, about progressives and liberals, right? That, you know, I think that Mary Eberstadt and others, they're absolutely right that identity politics, a big driver of it is family breakdown, the loss of community and the need to attach yourself to something larger than yourself. These needs exist in all human beings. It's what Robert Nisbet called the quest for community. And I spend a lot of time pointing out how these were real problems for those other people. And I didn't spend enough time thinking about how, no, these are just problems for Americans. And I think that's true of a lot of conservatives. And so, you know, And we're not just talking about poor people or people with low amounts of social capital. I think you're going to find these kinds of problems more with people who don't have resources. But look, I mean, there was this idiot woman, they write about her in the New York Post today, who flew a private jet and then started tweeting about how she stormed the Capitol and it was one of the best days of her life and all of these kinds of things. There are lots of people who are money rich but spiritually poor, who are looking for sustenance and meaning in their lives. And it's so sad and pathetic to me that so many of them have found it in Donald Trump. I don't mean that these are bad people, but I mean, I live my life arguing and talking about politics and writing about politics and thinking about politics. But I got to tell you, I've never really put that much of myself in politics. I don't get my sense of meaning from it. And I think that as, you know, churches and organized religion and stable communities recede from our lives and stop giving us sources of meaning, we are seeing the same trends on the left and the right, where people are just looking for whatever they can find to fill up that desire. And I think, you know, the large, centralized, bureaucratic, progressive welfare state is a big part of that problem. But it's not the only driver of that problem, because this is a malady that runs across the ideological spectrum, or certainly across the partisan spectrum. And it's just, I think, something that's really important to think about. Okay. What else is there to talk about? Oh, you know, it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me, okay, but it's bizarre that, you know, Trump cost the Republicans the Georgia runoff races. There was this guy who ran for the Public Service Commission in Georgia, and I got to do a deeper dive on this, but some 82-year-old Republican who outperformed both senators, both Republican candidates in Georgia, and won. Now, and won sizably. And so the thing is, the reason why this is relevant is that presumably the people willing to vote Republican on that down ballot race should normally be considered willing to vote Republican on the two Senate races. But Trump basically created a wedge issue that divided his own constituency, his own party, and united the other side. And so, you know, I don't know if Trump is, I mean, look, I think Kelly Loeffler is a terrible candidate. And while I'm in favor of all these people doing the right thing eventually, the fact that she dropped her objections to the election only after she lost, I do not think speaks particularly well of her. It just shows that she was perfectly happy to play along with that stuff. And as reporting seems to indicate, Trump forced her to say that she would oppose the electors in the Senate in order for Trump to come and do the rally that he did in Georgia. And so she agreed to do it. And so basically Trump forced her to alienate suburban voters who didn't like all of this garbage. And anyway, so Trump cost those two Senate seats, gave them to Republicans. And one of the weird silver linings, for want of a better term, for Donald Trump about all of this is that he completely took the conversation away from that and put it on what happened here in Washington on Wednesday, so that he is actually not getting as much blame as he should for handing the Democratic Party the Senate. And this gets back to the impeachment thing. It seems to me that, you know, again, I don't think he should be impeached because I care so much about the frickin' Republican Party at this point, but I do want the Republican Party to be a healthy, serious party. And I also want the Democratic Party to be a healthy, serious party. And I think both of them have real problems, but the Republican Party's problems are worse. And, So just talking to Republicans about their own narrow partisan self-interest, there is no reason to believe that if Trump ran again, or if Trump pretends to run again for the next 4 years, that he won't cause these kinds of problems over and over and over again. You know, Don Jr., in his sort of, you know, kind of cocaine sheen rant at the undercard part of that rally, was talking about how he's going to go in everyone's backyard who doesn't support the president in his effort to unconstitutionally steal the election. Well, that may still happen too. And so I just think, you know, purging the GOP of these problems, which is Donald Trump, is good for the Republican Party in its own narrow self-interest. And explaining that, you know, to people who actually claim to care about the Republican Party would be very useful. But also would, you know, go a long way to bringing back the suburban voters who have fled the Republican Party, in large part, you know, because of this thing I was talking about earlier, about how because they have other sources of meaning and do not invest themselves in politics the way that the new members of the Trump coalition do, the diehard Trumpists, who were never really voting for Republicans. They were voting for Trump wins. They were voting to expand the greater glory of Donald Trump. Well, by definition, those kinds of voters are less reliable than just sort of bread and butter, reliable suburban voters who turn out at elections. And I very much want both parties to be bourgeois parties. I want people who have bourgeois values to be the decisive voters in elections. The people who care about good schools, the people who care about safe streets, the people who care about low taxes, and who care about living within our means. Those are the kind of voters, whether they're pro-choice or pro-life, whether they're, you know, pro-gun or anti-gun. I mean, I care about those issues too, but I still want those kinds of voters to be the decisive voters in American politics. I don't want Occupy Wall Street yachts being the decisive voters in American politics, and nor do I want voters who wear frickin' Viking helmets and spread their own on the walls of Congress and beat, police officers to death to be decisive voters. And I don't think they are, because the QAnon crowd is a very small sliver. But I also don't want the people who think it's fine to have them in the Republican coalition to be the decisive voters. And there are a lot more of them. The idea that somehow you can have a party that includes, I mean, I had this argument with Hugh Hewitt 4 years ago about the alt-right. And to Hugh's credit, I think I changed his mind about it, because I think he was misusing and misunderstanding what the alt-right's about. But it's an existential, fundamental, philosophical thing. I will not be in a party that considers the alt-right to be members in good standing of the party. And similarly, the GOP should not be tolerant of members of QAnon or other conspiracy theorists. And frankly, of people who knowingly advocate for violating the Constitution in order to be on the right side of a cult of personality. And I want stable, boring voters to be the kingmakers in our politics, the people who turn out because it's civic duty and then they go on about their lives. I don't want radicals of the right or the left. I don't want people who think they are voting because of some re-enchantment creed or because that we're going to be delivered to some sunny new utopia defined in right-wing terms or in left-wing terms deciding these things. I want boring people to decide these things. You know, it's like I talk about with Kevin Williamson all the time. You know, I want to be more Swiss, you know, where you have these polls that show a lot of Swiss people don't know the name of the president of the United States. That's the kind of country I want to live in. I don't want to live in a kind of country where all of your meaning and identity is wrapped up in the chief bureaucrat of one branch of the federal government. And that's the way we've been heading for a very long time. That's what people felt about it for every election since George W. Bush, is they invest way too much in the cult of the presidency and they treat the presidency as this culture war thing. And yes, as a conservative, I definitely blame the expansion of the scope of government into our lives as one of the main reasons why people are investing so much importance in politics. But that still doesn't mean that I want to have cult of personality politics on the right either, because no president is going to deliver the things that people are expecting a president to deliver. And if you invest all of your meaning and your identity and in a single politician, you're going to get disappointed and you're going to do incredible damage to the country in the process. All right, I'm done ranting about all that. I'll stop. I do want to talk a little bit about a personal note. I know I mentioned this briefly in the intro to the podcast the other day, the one with Charles Murray, but and I mentioned it on Twitter. But my brother's widow, Chantal, passed away late in the night on the day before Christmas Eve, but I got the call first thing in the morning on Christmas Eve that Chantal had died. And Chantal was a beautiful, sweet-souled person who suffered from the worst form of sickle cell anemia. She was in terrible, terrible health for a long time. And sickle cell is an evil, horrible disease that is excruciatingly painful. And yet she never once indulged, at least in front of me or anybody I know who talked about her, in self-pity. She didn't treat herself like a victim. She handled it. She tried to be as good a person in life as she could be. And, you know, and one of the reasons I want to bring this up is that Chantal's sister wanted to talk to me about creating some sort of foundation about sickle cell, because one of the problems that people with sickle cell run into is, people with sickle cell tend to be of African descent for complicated reasons, complicated biological reasons. It has to do with the sickle cell genes and all this stuff. But they tend to get treated, unless if you go to public hospitals and all that kind of thing, they tend to get treated like addicts who are just there for drug seeking behavior. And Chantal didn't drink. She was not a drug addict. She wasn't any of these kinds of things. She was just in debilitating pain and was often treated terribly by hospitals that just sort of wrote her off as playing a game to get meds. And if you know anything about the kind of pain that a sickle crisis can cause, it's really infuriating. And it's particularly infuriating when it's someone who is a member of your family. And so, my brother's been dead for 9 years, and the whole thing brought back a lot of that. I've been, for the most part, taking care of Chantal because she can't work all of this time. My mom has helped out for a big chunk of it, but now it fell on me for the last few years. And it fell on me. There was a promise I made the day or the week that Josh died. I promised her that he's in a mausoleum thing, so it's not quite buried, right? But it's he's in a crypt and next to my dad, and I promised that she would be next to him. So I bought the thing and I paid it off over the years. And she also wanted a Jewish funeral, so I had to arrange that. And I had to arrange all of it starting on Christmas Eve, and with a plan on going to be with my wife's side of the family in Hawaii like the day after Christmas. And so that all got postponed. And getting to Hawaii without very recent COVID tests is impossible. So we had to arrange all that, ended up doing COVID tests in Denver and blah, blah. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about how inconvenienced I was in my Hawaii vacation by my sister-in-law's death, but it brings back all sorts of obvious emotions. And and some other things. I mean, like, I got to say, and I mean this in no offense to non-Jewish listeners out there, but the one thing other than deli meats that the Jews really have it on Christians or non-Jews is on the view that a funeral should not be an exercise in impoverishing people. That it shouldn't be gaudy, it shouldn't be extravagant, plain pine box, that kind of thing, which is entirely what Chantal wanted. But when we were trying to figure out on the fly how to organize all of this, you know, how to do a Zoom funeral and everything else over basically Christmas weekend, Chantal's sister called some Catholic funeral homes, and they were saying how the most inexpensive casket was something like $1,800, and it went up to $39,500. And I just think that's just a terrible way of going about these things. That's not to say I don't have complaints about some of the other other stuff in terms of, you know, where they get you and all of these things. But it's just going through this process again, which brought back all of these memories about my brother and my father, who both of whose graves I saw, you know, 10 days ago. It brings back sort of, I guess, some of the stuff that I was talking about before, about the real sources of meaning in people's lives. And the real source of meaning in your life has to start with family. And I understand that some people don't have great families. And that doesn't mean that they can't create something like a family of their own, or create not something like, but create an actual family of their own, to deal with the fact that they didn't have one growing up. But I really love my family. And one of the things I'm most jealous of my wife about is that she has this huge family. And one of the things you get with having a huge family is you have, you've diversified the repositories of institutional memory. You just have more people who can keep people's memories alive. It's just it's a purely a numbers thing where, you know, the more people you have to remember stuff and to talk about stuff and play remember when and all of that, the more you keep the stuff alive in your heart, or the easier it is to keep it alive in your heart. My wife, she's had her share of deaths in her family as well. She lost a brother in the last year. She lost a sister a few years ago. She lost both of her parents in the last, I guess, 5 years. But there are 20-something grandkids. There are still 7 of the siblings of my wife's generation around. And it's just a huge wellspring of memory and of, it's just a huge, you know, I talk a lot on the podcast about, you know, social capital and all of these kinds of things. Well, the sort of the Fort Knox of social capital is this feeling of belonging to a family. And the more people you have, the easier it is to sustain that and pass it on from generation to generation. And I remember when my brother died, and the first G file I wrote after I took time off for all of that, I wrote about this a little bit. And, you know, I made this point that, you know, first of all, the word unique gets a bad rap in some ways, or is misused sometimes. You know, people say, have the saying, you know, you can't be very unique. If something is unique, it's it's a set of one, it's one of a kind and all that kind of stuff. And I get the point. It's a pedantic point, or it's a grammarian's point or whatever, but it it misses something important. You know, they say all snowflakes, I don't mean the way I was talking about it before, I mean literal snowflakes, all snowflakes are unique. No two have the same shape. And that's right. But it just seems to me that if you had, you know, a black snowflake that was 10 feet wide, you would could say that's a very unique snowflake, and that it's just different. And the reason I bring that up is that all families are unique, you know, and I'm not making the sort of all families are happy in the same way, blah, 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 none of that stuff. I mean, each one is its own little civilization, its own little culture. It's got its own shibboleths, its own internal language, its own shared memories, and people can be invited into it and become part of it as immigrants. But they their experience, you know, it adds to the richness and the uniqueness of it. But at the end of the day, there are these small things that only a handful of people are in on. And when my brother died so young, I kind of felt like a huge chunk of the, for want of a better analogy, sort of the oral history of my civilization had just been wiped out. You know, you hear these stories about how in the, in Ukraine when the Soviets wiped out so much of the Orthodox Church there, a lot of their institutional memory was passed along orally and wasn't necessarily written down. And so you're really committing a kind of cultural genocide when you get rid of things like that, if you don't have the memory for it. You know, it's like people who still trying to keep like languages alive. Once the last person who actually speaks that language in a authentic way, having grown up in it, that language, it can be brought back, but it's not going to be brought back the same. And so I wrote this, I just called it up. This is from the GFOL I wrote, 9 years ago. Families are similarly unique. Each has its own cultural contours and configurations. Uniqueness might be hard to discern from the outside, and it certainly might seem trivial to the casual observer. But just as one platoon of Marines might look like another to a civilian, or one business might seem indistinguishable from the one next door. But as we all know, the reality is different. Each meaningful institution has a culture all its own. Each family has its inside jokes, its peculiar way of doing things, its habit and its mores developed around a specific shared experience. One of the things that keeps slugging me in the face is the fact that the cultural memory of our little family has been dealt a terrible blow. Sure, my mom's around, but sons have different memory of family than parents, and Josh's recall for such things was always not only better than mine, but different than mine as well. I remembered things he'd forgotten, and vice versa. In what seems like the blink of an eye, whole volumes of institutional memory have simply vanished. And that is a terrible, lonely thought that no amount of company and condolence can ease or erase. I'm really sorry. If I'd known I wouldn't be able to keep it together, I wouldn't have recorded this at all. But that's how I feel about Chantal going. She had memories of Josh that are now lost. She had memories of me that I don't remember that are now lost. And they had no kids. So it's kind of like this tiny little bit of civilization is just cleaved off. And, you know, as my people say, her memory is a blessing. But so my larger point is, building up these memories, building up your own little civilizations is where the really important work of life is done, and not all this stupid politics. I'll see you next time.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.